Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hello, Mormon Matters listeners. This is Dan Weatherspoon, hoping that everyone is well. I typically host a panel discussion for the podcast, but I also get lots of requests from folks, just especially emailing me this like, Dan, tell us more about your own journey and some of the things that kind of keep you going and offer you reasons for feeling optimistic within Mormonism and things like that. And so a month or so ago, we had a podcast that we called Being Authentic Within Mormonism, in which a couple of listeners who had kind of had these same sorts of questions, you know, interviewed me along with Nyland McBain about some of the things that kind of work as concepts or approaches or something that help us have a little peace along the lines within Mormonism. You know, it's one of those tough things where I don't want it to at all come across like ego or something like that, but I just have felt over the last couple of days that I'd like to share with you something that I delivered. I'll basically be giving you a longer version of something that I delivered up in Portland this past weekend up at the Sunstone Northwest Conference. I spoke on Saturday in Seattle and gave her a talk on a particular thing, and perhaps someday the Sunstone will release that, or maybe down the road we'll put it up here as a thing. But on Sunday night, we met in the basement of the Community of Christ Church there in Portland, and it was an unusual gathering. In the back of the room were a couple of quilts set up on frames, and anybody who was in attendance was welcome to go back there and do some tying of quilts. There was also a nice patchwork quilt over on the side and some pens and things, and we were encouraged to write messages of love and support. And those quilts were going to be donated to displaced LGBT youth whose families had kicked them out, especially I believe it was mostly LDS families we were focusing on. But it was just going to be some way of serving them and letting them know that they were in our hearts. And so the evening was an interesting evening of sharing. There were three of us who spoke and two who just gave wonderful musical numbers. But basically the evening, as Lindsay Hansen Park, Sunstone's new outreach director and symposium director, said, you know, this was a night to just share stories of hope, things that come together in your life that kind of have set part of your journey that makes you feel optimistic. So that's what I'm going to share tonight is the basic remarks that I gave up there. This will be a slightly expanded version. I can take my time. I can actually look at my notes. You know, when you're live in front of people, you don't generally want to stick very closely to your notes. You want to be present and make eye contact with everybody in the room. But here I am in my basement. I'm going to basically be sharing the remarks that I gave at the Portland Sunstone Northwest segment this past Sunday night, the 16th. This talk is, as I mentioned just a minute ago, Lindsay asked us to speak about hope, and it gave me the immediately went to my brain was the passage in 2 Peter 3, which simply says, you know, something along the lines of anybody who's a Christian, anybody who's spiritual, should be prepared and ready at any time to tell of the reasons for the hope that is within them. And so I took that as my charge for the evening. But I also had really been thinking a lot about the lines from Amazing Grace, and especially the lines that says, I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. And just, you know, what I was I decided to share was a little bit about some of my story, especially the early part of my story. So some of you have listened to, I don't know how much in my podcast, but I did an interview with John DeLynn, and there's a much more extended version of what you might hear there in terms of one of the segments here of just kind of my early years of struggle and whatnot before kind of, well, I'll just let the story unfold a little bit, but definitely a story of being lost and found, and then also tying in with the theme of Amazing Grace. I just want to share some moments of grace that came into my life, you know, acts of grace by other people or times when I just recognized that something had amazing had happened in me. So before I begin, for those, you know, I'm going to be telling a Mormon story, and it's going to be a Christian story. But even, you know, as I do this, I know that it's more than that. It's just really a human story, that what happened and the transformations that took place inside of me are ones that I'm sure, just with different narratives from different symbol systems and world religions and even non-religions and things like that, they're similar. You know, things can happen inside everybody, and they do happen the world over. So here we go. I don't want anybody to you know, feel like if you're triggered right now by Mormon expressions or Christian expressions that this might not be something that I hope you can still relate to. Now, for something to be lost, it kind of means that we once had it. We had at least some degree of awareness of it, and we're feeling a lack of its presence in our life. And so I'm going to talk about what I think was lost in me and then found again. For those of you who haven't heard this basic narrative, it goes something like this. For Dan Weatherspoon, I was born to really wonderful parents who were bright and educated, and they loved us kids, and we all inherited, you know, just good native intelligence and quick brains, and they were so verbal with us and things like that that we talked things over, and they were interested in our schooling, and so I just had a pretty easy time growing up. No problem with school. I had decent eye-hand coordination that made me an okay athlete. I wasn't necessarily shy, so I, you know, performed in these different plays. And back in Sacramento, California, where I grew up, they had declamation contests where you memorize poems and prose readings and things like that, and you stand and deliver. And I seemed like I won for my grade level all those early elementary school years. And I just had here's a kid with promise, here's a kid that can go conquer the world. And of course that fed over into church. You know, I was raised within the Mormon story that I was, hadn't quite at this early age known the term Saturday's warrior, but you know, we were saved for the latter days. We were the best and the brightest. We were choice spirits, and somehow, you know, this pre-earth life business of who we'd been before kind of determined how great our circumstances here. So I loved it. I bought into it. I, you know, just felt like, man, you know, I'm rocking the results of, you know, being a pretty good guy, pretty big spirit. So, I went on through junior high and all that stuff and really didn't struggle with much of anything. I know that as I got into age 16, beginning of 17 and things like that, I was kind of known among ward members and whatnot as kind of the kid that, you know, seemed to be the ideal. He was poised to go on a mission. I remember more than once having a mother come up to me, you know, as a priest or something, and say, you know, my 10-year-old or my 12-year-old son just really looks up to you. So thank you for being such a good example to him. And, you know, of course, I'm eating it all up. But, in the middle of my junior year or so, I started to panic. Everything that was easy to me started to look like, oh man, there's going to come a point where this raw intelligence and ability and gift of gab and all those different things are just not going to work for me quite as well. And I got afraid. I got afraid of life. I got afraid of becoming you know, really living up to the potential, you know, that I obviously I bought into myself as well as I, you know, had all those reinforcements about. So when I was presented with some chances to like, let's try a drink or let's smoke a little weed or something like that, I slowly but surely just kind of fell into patterns where I shifted over at least a good portion of me early on to that circle of friends and to doing those sorts of things. I still, and to this day, I still have two great friends from my high school years that were LDS, and we're still connected, and they were, you know, still a strong draw for me, so I didn't fully, like, you know, ignore them, or, you know, I probably tried to corrupt them a little bit, and they kind of tease me about it now, but they kept me, you know, at least during those high school years, a little bit still connected with all those things, but eventually, you know, just, you know, I began to cross one line after another in terms of my own behaviors, into the, we're talking different drugs, we're talking sex, we're talking all those different things, so that by the time I was, you know, even 18 years old, whatever golden boy glow I had, I was just, I just made sure that nobody ever thought that anymore. I just, you know, the pressure was off. No one was probably expecting me to go on a mission anymore. No one was really expecting me to, or whatever they were expecting me, there was much lower expectations. So I just did that, and I went to BYU after, I took 6 months off after high school, then I went to BYU for one semester and kind of straightened up a little bit. And determined to, you know, right the ship and embrace all the good things. But that summer home after, you know, because I went winter semester, I didn't go the fall semester. That summer was right there, and I just, it proved too much for me, and I fell into all my patterns again, and really started to struggle. So that when I came back to BYU that fall, I came back looking for and finding the party element that was there, and started hanging around with just different people, and you know, finding this dual life at BYU. I only lasted one more semester there when I got a job at a Village Inn Pancake House, and I just liked the money. School wasn't so fun, so I dropped out of school and just started to work. And eventually, I was the assistant manager at the restaurant. And, you know, and I now had money. I now had freedom from school and, you know, needing to do papers and things like that. And so I just went even deeper and deeper into the party scene. I met a really strong and very charismatic fellow, and we became best friends in the world. And he was my guide into, you know, even more exciting nightlife, as well as the world of cocaine. And, you know, our lives kind of centered around doing our work. And then certainly every Friday and Saturday night, but often Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night, then just going to the clubs, especially, you know, one in particular where we became regulars and new people and, you know, a lot of dancing, a lot of drinking, a lot of just you name it. But, you know, among the other things, there was, you know, cocaine was just became really, really important. It became super important to get that gram of coke for the week and the weekend. And so my finances, I just did terribly with those. I even had my bank disinvite me after a couple of years of even being a customer of theirs anymore. They, even though they're making $15 and $20 dings every time I, you know, floated a check and didn't quite get the new funds in place, they just said, you know, we're closing your account. Just get out of here. So I was falling apart. Eventually, you know, I ended up in jail, but none of that, you know, really deterred me. You know, so this was, I guess, age 21-ish that I was I was in jail for a little while, put on probation. But it just made me madder. It just, you know, I'm still determined to have fun and to escape real responsibility. I chased a girl to Florida, kind of broke my heart there, lasted 4 or 5 months there, came back and still fell back into, you know, patterns again with this good friend of mine. And slowly but surely just, you know, fell deeper and deeper into all this. So while it was going on, I do have to admit that there were these strange little moments. Some were just like I'd be stoned out of my brain or something like that and sitting around with a few friends and like, I'm going to straighten, I'm going on a mission. Or I would just like have different things and start to laugh at myself for saying things out. But there were two winter seasons, two Thanksgiving to Christmas seasons, that something strange began to happen in me. I normally was listening to classic rock or, you know, even pretty hard, you know, metal kind of stuff. But in Utah, there's this station called FM 100 that plays Christmas music every year. And during that time, I would catch myself going over to that station and listening to seasonal stuff. But I began to notice that I wasn't really caring anything about Jack Frost nipping at your nose or Winter Wonderland or Silver Bells or any of the seasonal things as much as it was the Christmas ones, the real nativity ones, the ones about Christ and Jesus and all the different, spiritual stuff. And, you know, I kind of cracked myself up, and I certainly wasn't doing that when my friends were in the car with me and things like that, but I just would, like, feel something stirring in me even as I was, you know, kind of ignoring any other kinds of spiritual feelings. When I wrote about it, when I was at Sunstone in one of my editorials, I think I used something along the phrase of, like, instead of marijuana grass, I was looking for a fix of manger hay. I can't remember what it was, but it was just this really strange thing to have to reflect on. Why is this going on in me? And then there was also a season, I'm not quite sure what time of year, that I would just begin to show up for church the next day after partying all that weekend. And it wasn't conscious on my part that I can remember. I'm going to go back to church. As things like I would seem to wake up, I would put on some clothes, I would go, I would sit in the back, I wouldn't look at anyone, I wouldn't smile at anyone, I would just kind of sit there in pure numbness. I even went on to the young adult Sunday school class, and the reason I even remember that, I don't remember anything other than just having done this for a couple of months of fairly regular attendance. I wasn't sure that I knew anybody's name. I didn't think anyone would have known my name because it didn't seem like I'd ever really interacted with anybody. But I was there enough that at the close of class one day, it was a young woman who was the class president. She just, out of the blue, Dan, would you give the closing prayer? And I was, like, not prepared for that. I was in shock. I was numb. I absolutely hadn't prayed in so many years. And I just couldn't. I sat there frozen. And there was this one guy, and he had kind of, as I reflect later, he had seemed to be the guy I liked the best in the class. He kind of, you know, had at least some sense of what was going on with me and would smile at me or whatever. And he just quickly stood up and did the prayer without, you know, saying anything or making any kind of fuss. And my sense is I never went back from the trauma of that. But I'm only sharing it here as kind of just a way of saying, you know, in the midst of all this being lost kind of things, there was something deep in my spirit that was, you know, like calling to me, like saying, you know, what you're doing right now isn't where the answers are. There's something higher. There's something, you know, calling from within me to kind of, you know, end this little business here. But I didn't. All the details are a little bit fuzzy in terms of what exactly led to continued devolving. But it got to the point where I was, you know, really beginning to start with some suicidal ideation kind of things. One in particular terrible moment, and I believe I've shared about this on the podcast before, was a fight with my mom off and on during this period. Well, I mostly lived on my own, but there was a period of time, and in fact, when this Sunday school thing happened where I had moved back with my mom, I think it was after my Florida, trip to chase Vicky. But we got into just some major fight and I just did some things and said some things there that made me feel super powerful because I could hurt her so badly. And that's where I think I've shared about the experience of feeling like I heard Satan's voice laughing at me You know, you can think of Moses 7 and Satan laughing as he sees the children of humans doing this. But this was a very personal thing. It was like Satan saying to me, I got you, Weatherspoon, man. Ha ha ha, I own you. You could not make a good decision now if you tried. Everything that you do, you've chosen the easy way. I mean, I'm adding some language here, but it was just this very clear message that you're stuck and you've given away, you know, any kind of ability to choose right, so that I just own you. You know, it's just a matter of time here before I own your soul. And of course, this is all within that symbol system of Satan and Lucifer and all that stuff, which I had never really questioned before. I'm acting against God and I'm acting against Mormon standards, but I hadn't really questioned the validity of those things at that point at all. So anyway, so after that was the real depression, and I know that came in the fall again, the fall to the late winter, or early part of winter, because I was in a state where I was thinking about suicide more often. I can't remember if I even had a job at the time. Anyway, things were really black. When all of a sudden, in I believe it was in mid-January of the year, and this would have been 1982. My uncle calls me, and he just simply said, "You know, Janie and I, his wife Janie, and his name is George. We've been thinking about you, and you know, we don't know what's going on with you, but." You know, would it help if you came and lived with us? Would you like to move out here? And so just from a move from Provo, Utah to Mapleton, Utah, and that invitation was basically still probably the biggest act of pure grace that I've ever received, because I was a mess, and I, you know, smoked and I smelled and I wasn't living right, and I believe their oldest child at the time was probably 17 or 18, and they had all the way down to, I believe, probably a 5-year-old daughter was their youngest at the time. And, you know, they were going to let me come and live with them and, you know, just get some breathing room. But for whatever reason, as negative and as lost as I was, I chose yes. And I can't even imagine it, you know, offering something like that today to someone else, though I want to. And I would certainly be open to those opportunities myself. But anyway, just living in their home was neat. They were a fun family. I always liked them. We'd grown up near each other when we all lived in San Diego, and so I knew them. And I didn't want them to think worse of me. And so I would certainly do my best to put on my best behavior type thing. But I still stepped outside and smoked. And you know, somehow when you're a smoker, you don't realize that there's no way to hide that. You know, so I'm thinking with various precautions or whatnot, they're not going to really smell it. But they just never commented on it or anything like that. And slowly but surely, just the fun family life and just the rhythms and just being out of the cycles and the routines that I had been in began to work on me a little bit. So, you know, within, I'm sure, a few weeks or a month or so, I was, you know, attending church with them and being quiet and kind of reminding myself of stories and Mormon life. But, you know, they weren't like this guilt-inducing family for any of them. They lived Mormonism kind of on a really neat, light level, not light as in we don't take it seriously, but just they're not guilt trippers. They're not, you know, heavy-handed, you know, iron rodders or whatever you would call, for some of you know that terminology. But slowly but surely, my spirit reasserted itself, and eventually, and some of this might be familiar to you, I read the Book of Mormon. I went to Education Week with my aunt one day, and we ended up in a session, and the guy just talked about the Book of Mormon, and I took a challenge to my heart to read the Book of Mormon. And I did that, and so this is now 8 months or so after this journey. I had just one little weird moment in there. It was in late June of that same year where the family went on vacation, and I had a job. I was delivering nuts and, like, banana chips and filling in bulk bins at different places all over Utah for a nut company. And I had to work, and they were going on vacation, and they left for like a week. And seriously, it was a really, really strange moment where my friend, I just won't name his name, just because I still love this guy in my heart, but he just had so much power in my life. But in terms of like, there was the action, man. This dude's Mr. Charisma and all that stuff. Anyway, he called me after not having called me for a few months, and while they were gone on vacation, I went to the clubs again, and I went that Thursday, and I went that Friday, and I went that Saturday, and it was on that Saturday as I'm driving home, and I've just been thinking about, how happy I was, just not doing these things. And here I'd gone back into these 3 days of doing it. And it was right there at that moment as I'm driving by this orchard along 1600 North in Mapleton, Utah, that I just looked at the cigarettes that were on the dash. And I just, somehow deep within me, my spirit just cried out, I am better than these things. I am better than these cigarettes. And out the window they went, and I think I've told how it's just in my mind's eye, it's like slow motion. You can see the revolution of the pack as it soars. It was like, obviously, like Superman's toss in terms of distance, at least how it plays out in my own head. But just as I just saw those cigarettes arcing towards the ground, and that was the last time I'd ever smoked. And so that was a couple of months. That was the end of June, and Education Week, I think, is always early August. So within that period, I'd quit smoking. And so I was a little bit more prepared to read the Book of Mormon and to keep moving on this path. And then as I read the Book of Mormon, you don't have to get in too far before you hit the Sons of Mosiah and Alma the Younger. And just, again, I haven't questioned any historicity or any of that kind of stuff, but these guys spoke to me as, similar dudes, golden boys, anything they want. They could have done this way. They chose to, fight against God, to fight against their own spirits, whatever you'd want to say it, and yet they had made some changes and had reasserted themselves and became really, powerful dudes. And I began to think to myself, man, maybe I can do that too. Maybe I can contribute positively again. And it's still very, very hard to pray. It was really, really, I just remember pacing the floor for many a night. I'd read the scriptures, and then I'd get up, and I'm going to pray, and I couldn't. I just, throw down myself on my knees every once in a while, but then after a bit of not being able to, just break my heart open or whatever, I would stand up and then give up and try another night. And finally, it seems to me 3 or 4 nights of this pacing, and I've got to pray. When I finally was able to, and I, within just the opening of, Dear Father in Heaven, the next 15 minutes, it seems, were just pure sobbing at the fallenness, the lostness, the botching my life. And it was cathartic, and it was wonderful. No angels came. Part of me was thinking, oh, the prodigal son returns, and all that kind of stuff, and I would get, just like some major manifestation. But instead, I got just the perfect message, and this will kind of be a theme that will come through some of the stuff I say here. I just got the message of, welcome. Welcome back. We got work to do. But it was very affirming of me and the place that I was, and it was just simply like, yep, let's go to work together. And so God and I, we went to work together. Every night it seemed like my prayers were 45 minutes to an hour long. A lot of it was groveling and feeling like I needed to just apologize, and yet those were not even powerful parts of my prayer. And as I've grown in my own spirituality later, I'm just so confident that, you violate eternal law, and therefore there are eternal consequences, and you better beg in order for the mercy of Christ to apply to all that stuff. It just doesn't sing to me anymore, and it really didn't sing to my experience then, but that was a big part of that early prayer life. But still, I was just, in touch with my higher self, and my spirit was kind of winning the day a little more often than it wasn't, in no way perfect or anything like that. But one morning at breakfast, I happened to be just sitting around the table. My uncle was off to my left, and I just don't, I hadn't, I know I hadn't thought of it. I seriously did not even imagine what would come out of my mouth, but it was like, you know, I really think I want to go on a mission. And he like puts down the paper, looks up, goes, what? And I guess I must have said, he goes, well, let's go talk about that. And we picked up our juice and walked down the hall to his office. And he happened to be the bishop of the ward at this time that I was living there with him. And we began, you know, a very interesting process of like, are you serious? And this and all the different steps that you need to do, especially when there's been sexual stuff that had been, you know, part of your life. And we ended up having to meet with the general authority and kind of him approving of, you know, I guess either discernment that I was forgiven. But my only real memory of it was with William Grant Bangeter, and it was a very good experience, but I have two strong memories of it. One was just making sure that I didn't have any children in the world that I wasn't, you know, supporting. And then, you know, later after just, you know, 15 minutes of chatting and various things, him asserting to me that I want you to know that God has forgiven you and your choice and all those different things. And then he said, you know, as you are on your mission, he goes, let me warn you that there will be times when you'll be discouraged, that you'll feel like you've blown it, that you're behind the curve, that you've, that somehow or other, you know, this can never be made up. You're going to, you know, you need to forgive yourself. Don't let Satan work on you. In other words, to be discouraging to you because of this interlude in your life. And so that was a powerful thing. And that really did end up happening on my mission a lot, and maybe sometime I've even shared it on the podcast. It's hard to remember, but I did have at least one really big experience that was major in a neat way related to kind of passing through that, but I won't go into it here. But anyway, I got my mission call around November, so I believe this was the 1st of October. By the middle of November, late November, I'd gotten my call, and I was going to be called to the Seattle, Washington mission, the Washington-Seattle mission. I was to report in February. And so it was neat that Christmas to have everything be related to, you know, getting stuff for your mission. And I still lived with my aunt and uncle, but I spent Christmas Eve and Christmas Day with my family who had all gathered. Some of them were, you know, we're all mostly adults. I think my sister was the only one who really lived at home. But my family and I were sitting around in my mom's house in Provo opening gifts, and I remember getting like a laundry bag that said Elder Spoon, and it had a, you know, the stencil of the Washington Seattle mission on it. And I remember getting like a thick zipper bag for my scriptures to protect from the rain there in Seattle when I'm riding my bike and all that stuff. But as we gathered together, I just wanted to share you know, I looked around there and I had one of those moments of, you know, I'll call it grace again, where I realized as I sat back and looked at my family, who I had been alienated from for nearly 5 years and who I'd done mean things to and I'd disappointed and I'd hurt, and I just kind of stepped out of myself a little bit, and I just saw us laughing together. I saw us, you know, celebrating each other, just doing perfect, you know, open hearts to each other. And it just, it occurred to me, it was this moment of like, they don't even remember me. They don't even remember me from these last 5 years. You know, I guess, you know, you would ask them factually, they would know that that was who I was. But any of the pain, any of the hurt had been gone. So whether through their own forgiveness or just purely the grace of God or whatever it was, you know, I never had to worry about my family's love and those things. And that was just really, really a powerful moment of grace. I'm going to jump out of my personal merit narrative here. And I want to do Luke chapter 15 with you. Pieces of this have again showed up in various podcasts. Some of this reading of the parable of the prodigal son was influenced a lot by my good friend Phil McLemore, who's been on the podcast before. But I've also taken to a lot of study of this parable that we'll mostly spend time with, and this whole chapter on my own. And I think there's some pretty neat and powerful things about being lost and then found. and grace in this. So Luke 15 is a very, very interesting chapter, and it's one that whoever divided it up into the different chapters recognized that there was an interesting and powerful theme together, so because it ties three different stories along with a setting. And the setting is, it says, as you know, Jesus is basically teaching, there drew new to him all the publicans and the sinners to hear him, and yet the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, "This man receiveth sinners, and he eats with them." And so in that context of, you know, those guys, you know, missing the bigger point is what we're going to learn that Jesus is teaching them. He then shares three different stories. The first two very quickly. Those who among you have 100 sheep, if you'd lose one, wouldn't leave the 99 and go after the lost one. Another time, what about the woman who would have 10 coins and she loses one and she can't find it and she does everything and everything, and finally when she finds it, she calls all of her friends and let's rejoice together. And you know, in appealing that, of course, this is the way that we should act and the way we should feel about precious things, he then tells the story of the man with two sons, and it is called often, most often referred to as the parable of the prodigal son. But in the telling that I'm going to give, and certainly this is a precedent in a lot of biblical scholarship, we'll call it the parable of the two lost sons. We'll concentrate first on the parable of the younger son, the one that the bulk of the passage does talk about, but then we'll try to do some interesting things with the older son as well, and how I think that we've so misread in many ways that passage. And you know, you could see that the scripture kind of maybe misses it himself, or it just, this is one of those places where you really wish it would have spent more time on one aspect of the story, because I think the reading that we'll give today is clearly the one that would be in alignment with the rest of the passages, as well as lots of other things in Christ's teaching. So of course, you know, the prodigal son part of it is that there was the son, and he's the younger son, and he says, you know, "Dad, you know, he knows the laws of inheritance and things like that, and his portion isn't going to be as big as his brother's." And, you know, and at the time when his father dies, there wouldn't be as, you know, he wouldn't be have the same status. So he basically asked Dad to take his inheritance now and to move off on his own. And the scriptures kind of hurt us a little bit, I think, by talking all in one verse. And not many days after the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, it says he there wasted his substance with riotous living. And, you know, one of the things we've got to know is that we do not need to assume that that was that son's desire. Give me all the money so I can go party. I'm so open to reading this as the human journey of all of us. Phil's the one that first alerted me to think of our divine inheritances, what we've taken with us, our inheritance down to this earth, and we had no desires to screw it up. We had no desires to get lost and things like that, but some of us do. And well, I'm going to say all of us do. We just get lost in different ways. And so in this case, it was, you know, the excess of fun and chasing, you know, pleasure and things like that in this son. But we don't need to assume that his or any of our intent was ever to do that, even though we may have followed in those patterns. But, you know, this son here of this younger son, as he's out there, things are getting worse and worse, and he loses all of his substance, and there's a famine in the land, and he gets work with a person, and he basically, you know, feeds the swine for this somebody, and you know, it says in there that he would fain to have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, but no man gave unto him. So he was hungry and was even a little bit envious of, you know, having some meals given to him, even if it would have been terrible ones. And then verse 17 has the wonderful phrase from the King James Version, "And when he came to himself," you could do a whole sermon on "came to himself." He recognized something. This is a transitional moment in his life. He came to himself and he says, how many hired servants of my father have who have bread enough and to spare, and yet I perish with hunger. I'll just go to my father, and I will say unto him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before thee. I'm not worthy to be thy son, but please can I at least live the life and be a servant for him? And so he chose to do that. He mustered his strength and humility to go do that. And when he arose to his father, when he was yet away off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And then the son immediately, Dad, you know, Father, I've sinned against heaven and I've sinned in thy sight and I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. And then just this is the message. The father says to his servants, bring forth the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and let's be merry, for my son was dead and is live again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. Man, there's a lot of stuff that goes on here, but you know, a robe, ring, shoes, these were the symbols of the family. These are the symbols of divine inheritance. You know, if nothing else, there, no matter what you did, son, no matter how empty you're coming back here, you're still my son. I see your place in my home always. You haven't blown it. Something along those lines that we can do. And that is just the key message. And of course, even after the party, even after the coming back, the parable just doesn't give us that time to really reflect, which would have to have been, which is day by day, opportunity upon opportunity, some forward steps and some back steps, the son and the father working it together, the father teaching his son how it is to, you know, to really be who he fully is as a son and not as a servant, as somebody who, you know, was simply lost and is now found and working his way back to his full glory. And so if we think about, you know, that in terms of that journey of it's all of us, we come here, we're divine beings, we get lost along the way, but there's nothing. This is the parable that tells us there's nothing that we can do that isn't, that could cause us to lose our divinity, to lose that essential perfection and total potential and all that stuff that's in us. We can cover it up and we can bury it and we can screw it up and all that stuff, but they'll always be there. And, you know, just as the father goes to see the son, even when it's just like a rumor that he might be coming nearby, that's exactly where God is. He's always there, just waiting for any kind of moment of us coming to ourselves, any kind of hint that our spirit is ready to kind of hear the deeper truth about itself. And so it's just so powerful. And, you know, the prodigal son, that portion of it, certainly I relate to. In those prayers and that working things out over the next few months as I prepared for a mission and then on my mission and then even, you know, I'm still having to work it out all the time. Just those neat messages from God that, you know, yeah, you're not always doing it at the right pace and you're kind of going back and you're getting lost here and there, but always the message is that you're, that I see you, I see the goodness, I see the bigness in you. So let's talk about this older son. We know that he was in the field, he comes in, he hears all the music, he, you know, smells the calf being cooked and all that stuff, and he says, what the heck's going on here? He talks to one of the servants, hey, thy brother has come and their father has killed the calf, and because he's received him safe and sound, they're so happy. And, you know, here's the typical guy going, man, dad's never done that for me. You know, I'm the one here doing what I'm supposed to. Here's my idiot brother over there. And, you know, he was just full of resentment, full of anger that this would be a celebration when he was the dutiful one and nobody's celebrating him. And so he refuses to come in. And his father, again, hears that he is, you know, there and goes to him. And the son, you know, gives him his complaint, and then the father says, you know, son, guess what? All that I have is yours. You know, there's never a doubt that you're still fully my son. you still have every promise. This changes nothing that your brother also has that promise. You have the promise as well. It's meet that we should make merry. Be glad. Your brother was dead. Now he's alive. He was lost. He's now found. That is all that matters, is that we're found. And and in doing this to the older son, he's reaching out and he's trying to find him in his lostness. And this older son represents those scribes and the Pharisees, the murmurers, who, you know, this parable, you know, if it had spent some more time on this, you know, maybe it didn't need to because of the context of this. Jesus is saying to this older son, you're the Pharisee. You're the one who is lost. But your loss is not as visible. It's not as easy to spot. It's, you know, it's, you're lost in duty. You're lost in righteousness. You're lost in all these ways, but you're, you know, doing down a formula and not really living with an open heart as you have. You haven't learned compassion. And so he's just as lost, but he's lost because of righteousness. He's lost because he thought that he had it all figured out and he was on the way. And so the first thing that anybody would have to do to that person is say, okay, yeah, you've missed it. You've missed the theory. You've kind of been doing the one things, and that's great. And it's neat that you haven't, squandered, you know, so all these different things, but you also haven't learned to have a broken heart yet. And so, I can just, again, imagine, what is the next 20 years? What is the next 30 years like? Oh, the father with this son and working the two brothers together and teaching them that, you know, there's more than one way to be lost. And the key thing is for both of you guys to realize is everything that I am, you can be. Anything that I am is yours. My life is available to you. That's never in doubt, no matter how either one of you are lost. All right, I'm going to jump back into my personal narrative here, but I'm not going to be in any kind of level of detail that I was before. I just want to make the larger point, so this will be more of a 10,000-foot level kind of view than down in the weeds about my faith crisis. As I mentioned before, I hadn't really questioned the Mormon narratives. I hadn't done anything other than to simply reject growing up and taking adult responsibilities and things like that. And so all of my earlier struggles were about just simply, you know, needing to gain confidence that I was a good person again after having lost sight of that. So after my mission and things like that, I, you know, was taught at the MTC. I was planning to become a seminary and institute teacher when I, just learned through student teaching that I just wasn't that interested in teaching teenagers. I wasn't at the right vibe for that, and so I thought I'd go on to grad school and perhaps, you know, eventually teach in the institute program, teach college students or whatever. And I went on to study religion, and it was in the process of that, you know, the more formal crisis of faith transition began, and it was one that lasted a long, long time. And I guess what I wanted to simply tell of that right now is the piece that even though it was difficult, even though it was hard, and I did figure it out, that it was basically 1989 or late 88 until sometime in the middle of 2000. So for 12 years of struggle and not being sure if I really could land in the place where I was sure that I could stay within Mormonism, that Mormonism would be an integral part of my spiritual journey. There were moments of grace, and I just wanted to quickly mention those, but also these graceful moments, the key message of those things was the same as what we were just talking about with the prodigal, or the same thing that God was kind of telling me in my prayer life and thing like this, is don't sweat it. You cannot blow the core goodness the essentialness of you. And I guess I want to offer this right now for those of you who are struggling with lots of different things. That, like, if that's the message that you can be centered in, and if you can experience that, however it is, and I'm sure right now it's going to be through other people, that maybe it only seems like a vague possibility because, oh, perhaps I ought to believe them, and even though it hasn't happened to me yet, I can trust their words a little bit, you know, but eventually you got to get to it yourself. But if you can have that core sense of you're not blowing it by questioning these things, the rest of it can come much easier. It's still going to be hard. It's the wrestle of your life. It's Jacob, you know, every ounce of energy with God. But you get to the point where you truly can, like Jacob, demand the blessing and receive it, and receive it in a wonderful way, and be a changed being from having gone through the wrestle. So I'm just going to share just a couple of, you know, like I say, 10,000 foot level kind of reflections on my faith journey. Other podcasts I've certainly done more, and my panelists, you know, my amazing panelists have offered more strategic things, like here's a way of thinking about it, or here's a practice that serves me, and when I try to do this or when I try to do that, this seems to be make things go easier. But that won't be today. This will be just more the core idea that I've been trying to convey. So as I struggled in 1989, first moment of grace was pretty interesting circumstances. I won't share them here, but how Randy Paul and I became friends. And Randy, you'll recognize from having probably been on 10 episodes or something here too. He's just been my friend and a mentor for me for all these years, ever since, and to this day, he still stands so tall for me as the person who first made me believe that I wasn't blowing it by having a faith crisis and asking the questions that I was asking and bringing my scholarship into conversation with the gospel, and that I didn't need to fear these things. And, you know, he heard a lot of sarcasm and cynicism and me being a blowhard and me, you know, making these huge pronouncements, and he took it and he smiled and he was patient, and he never once, you know, his message again was, don't sweat it. I've been there. And you know, I see you. I see that this is the key wrestle of your life, and just hang in there. And so just that grace, I've shared. You know, again, strange circumstance. 9 years after this, that I sit next to James Fowler on a plane, and I don't know that God arranged it. I don't know that angels were busy, you know, booking us into the same seat row. But that was so key, that a moment of grace came when we had that conversation, and I went and quickly bought his book and then refamiliarized myself with Stages of Faith. And of course, that's been a key thing for me. But all along, even just during, you know, the times in between those moments of grace, there were just times to just let you know that, you know, you would hit on something and it would sing to you, and it would remind you that, you know, all the things that you're focused on that are so negative, there's some positives there too. And you'd feel heaven smile, or at least, you know, I quit talking in second person. I would feel heaven smile. I would feel that God approved this journey, and there wasn't any timetable for it, and you should get there faster than you were. It was just like, this is you, and you got to work this out, and this is the key wrestle of your life, and this is the key journey for all human souls, is to figure out who you are in yourself, your character, and to integrate the you know, the stuff of your deepest core self to make it be the dominant presence in your waking life, and that those moments of life and the things that you have to do that make it hard to remember your core self. And so whether you're a Buddhist or whether you're, you know, a Christian or something like that, it's the same thing. Is like, don't get distracted by all the things that are thoughts and emotions and messaging and everything that can distract you. You know, somehow learn to quiet yourself in you know, practice and in moments to feel fed by the deeper truth of you, which is the essential divinity. So, you know, we're dead on with everybody who loves Eastern traditions. We've got it in Mormonism, and we've got it in Mormonism, especially even more than Christianity, because we have this whole greater comfort with, you know, talking about ourselves as divine and eternal beings rather than created beings and things like that. But any of us, we still all get it that, you know, somehow the messaging of the world, and we take into ourselves, you know, negative things that our parents may have said or our friends may have said and whatnot, and we start to think, oh, this is me, I really am, and we get a distorted view of ourselves and things like that. And so that's what we've got to get over. So I just wanted to kind of say, during the faith crisis, during the wrestle, during the transition time, if somehow or other you can keep that in mind and notice when something in your body feels different, you know, there's something that feels lighter or warmer or richer, and consider that a grace and something, and pay attention to it. You'll find it more and more often, kind of being more and more dominant. So I just wanted to kind of put that there in front of you. I'm 55 years old now, and I only offer that as a piece of encouragement, for, because I know so many people, you know, it's in your 20s and your 30s that you begin to work through this stuff. Sometimes it's even later and things like that, but it took me a lot of years. But I don't want to say any of this next part in any way that feels all ego-driven or like I've accomplished something that, you know, is oh so great or whatever. I just wanted to kind of close with just an expression of noticing what has happened in me and put it out there as something that I think could, I believe it's happened in many, many people that I love and I admire, and somehow or other through all this mess and craziness, it happened in me. And that is, you know, I've talked a lot about grace, but I've found grace, and I, you know, this is the weird part to say. I think I've settled into a state of grace of some sort. You know, it doesn't mean I don't have bad days, and doesn't mean there are days that I don't screw up and go hide and want to curl up in a ball and just fall apart and say screw all this. But but because of this messaging, this walk with God, and this strong sense of my spirit, you know, being so much more alive, and because it's uncovered by so much of the stuff, because of that, I feel like I walk in grace, and I guess this is the key part for those of us who are struggling so much with Mormonism. I think is because of that I'm able to grant grace. People will ask me more than anything, you know, how is it that you can do it? How can you put up with this smallness, this meanness, this sexism, this racism? How can you put up in Mormonism? And how do you still stay optimistic when all you see around us is all these things where it's small and it's broken and it's narrow and things like that? And I guess you know, I'm not in this time. Obviously, at other times I've been more explicit about perhaps some strategies and some different things. But this time, I just want to simply say that it really helps to know that I'm good with God, that I'm on a path, that there's no perfection expected, but it's a path of compassion and greater heart and openness. And, you know, just, I guess if nothing else changed over the last 10 years, it was like, now I'm able to, I've always been able to identify with the other prodigals, but now I'm able to have, or find myself more often being able to have an open heart and a compassion for the older brother type lost folks, the people who are pretty much most often in leadership in our wards and stakes and, who, you know, again, I'm not saying that they're as lost as the older brother was at the moment that we meet him in the story, but they're the ones who've, you know, perhaps not had the same challenge of the prodigal life, and who have to have their hearts broken and opened to compassion, you know, in other ways, through service and through listening to each other, and to truly let somebody in and their struggle in, and to let it complicate their lives, and to hear. And there's so many of them that are just, you know, so many leaders and things like that are barely in that process themselves of learning how to do that and to have their hearts broken. But I'm able to now see that. And to generally, not all the time, oh man, I screw up left and right, but to generally at least step back and to have that grace to simply say, this is the dynamic, they're angry, they're, you know, they're acting out of fear here or something like that, rather than the hugeness of their spirit that's there, and can I see that, and can I see their goodness, can I see their trying and whatnot, and that's just the grace that I have. And that's, if you were to ask me, what is it that, how is it I'm able to do it? Is it, it's like everything that, you know, you see that, like, oh, they're being really hyper orthodox here and saying this is just the way it is, or that or the other thing is, you know, shoring up some kind of like perceived threat to their worldview. Or, you know, they've listened to, you know, the world's going to hell in the handbasket. Or they've listened to, you know, Satan is, you know, God and Satan are doing their sorting of who's on whose thing. And so they've got all these theories in their head and things like this, but they're all based upon fear, or they're all based upon nervousness, or this lack of security in who God says and tells them that they are. And so when they don't have that, I want to nurture them rather than, you know, just yell back. I mean, I do yell back sometimes, and I, you know, I have to gather my resources, and I have to come back and recharge my batteries and go back into the fight. But I guess I just wanted to say that because of my learning and truly knowing, and this is the message, if any of you are in this, just know that you haven't you're on a good journey. You know, no matter how angry and cynical you are right now, because it is hard. It's hard to be there and to be the one who's moving and to have the center not seem to move. And so you're the one that's taking the journey a little bit away from them. And so, and you want them to come with you, or you want to be seen by them, or you want to be heard by them, and you want to have your issues become their issues, number one, and all that stuff. But if we can just know that what's at the core of this not happening is things that were not necessarily of their choosing, they're not necessarily things that they're aware of, that it's most likely fear, it's most likely something painful, and it's protection or whatever it is, and all things that if we saw them in our child, we would naturally want to reach out and nurture. That is, oh, I hate to say, where I go more often. I do go there more often than I was ever able to before. And it's not as deliberate anymore. It's not as like, I better do this. It's less of a thinking process now. It's more just an outflow. And I guess that's what I'm trying to say, a state of grace. And so perhaps that helps. Perhaps that will let you know, at least from my experience, it's possible. It has been a process that it doesn't feel like mental gymnastics to me to, you know, hold our stories and our narratives and our symbols as stories, as narratives, as symbols. But I've just, in this whole process, I'm grounded in something deeper. I'm grounded in that deeper truth that what was a core is simply gets buried over, it gets covered over, but it's always there, and it's always always trying to assert itself. It's like the little plant shoot, you know, trying to reach for that sun all the time. It's there, and if we give it any chance to nurture and to flower, it will. And so I just pray and hope that anybody who listened to this today and has lasted this long with me, just the reason for the hope within me is because I know who I am. And I know that in every screw up and in every backward step, God hasn't seen me in any different way than I would see my child who's falling. But I always know their divinity. I always know their goodness. and I'm always going to react to that and give those messages of encouragement. So if it's guilt or if it's shame or if it's anything that makes you feel small or less than, just know that it's not from God and that's not of your spirit. That's of cultural messaging, and that's of, you know, parents who are fearful or friends that are, you know, insecure or something like that, and we've picked that up and we've internalized it and we've let that cover over that core stuff. But you know, just keep working on coming to yourself and trusting and having, especially, you know, experiences. And I just believe that grace will attend you.
I love and appreciate all of you fellow travelers. Thanks for letting me ramble a lot today, but I hope there was something in here that can be meaningful and encouraging to you. Back to normal formatting next time for sure with the panel. Good night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.